This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Campbell McGrath with Michael Silverblatt, recorded in Santa Fe, March 30th, 2005. Campbell McGrath, the MacArthur Fellowship-winning poet and devotee of the road trip, brings his quirky and inventive mind to voice his fascination with the high and low of American culture. In this program, he reads a variety of poems from his 6 published books before joining in conversation with Michael Silverblatt of Bookworm.
Aren't you kind? Thank you very much. Welcome to the Lenzik Center for Lannan's Readings and Conversation Series. I'm very happy to be here again. It's always an honor. This time especially because, you know, when I was called up by the foundation, both Joe and Karen said, when I said that I didn't know Campbell McGrath's work yet, they said, oh, just say yes, you'll love him. And in fact, I did. You know, I got all the books, as I always do, and I thought, you know, I haven't read poetry like this in years. It reminded me of the fact that when I was a boy, there'd be these anthologies of poetry, and there'd be whole sections of poems about America. About America, American vistas, American landscapes, American cities. They'd have these horrible names like crowded vistas and things like that. But you know, the poems would be written by Carl Sandburg, by Stephen Vincent Benet. You'd find them. And you know, it became, I think, impossible after a certain point politically to write poems about America. There was a certain amount, perhaps, of shame, and poets were disinclined to, and it took a very long time until Campbell McGrath practically invented an American poem that was both a celebration and a horror show. So that, you know, you're working between the fruited plains and the Chuck E. Cheese, you know, and the whole extraordinary ambivalence that we feel as Americans, both about America and about poetry, is answered in these Campbell McGrath poems, who finds it possible to, through the extraordinary, I would say, American language of snake oil salesmen, carny show barkers, to write the noise of America. In fact, his second book is called American Noise. It's a hustle. At the same time, it's that strange erudition that made sociologists invent whole new terms for our vulgarity. And then those terms become the new words, the Baudrillard words, with which we talk about society of spectacle, you know. And I think that this was an amazing development in American poetry, because we hadn't heard, you know, William Carlos Williams told us the pure products of America go crazy. Allen Ginsberg celebrates in America that puts his mother in the insane asylum. You know, we know what America does to people, but we don't know that still our poets are, if they were born the way Campbell McGrath was, with a father giving him a dog-eared copy of Jack Kerouac, he went right out on the road. You can't imagine how many places his little car with people named Charlie and Ed, who recur from poem to poem, there he is, sitting on a hill watching the sun go down. The next day he's out looking for the wild horses that aren't there, no matter how far he looks. There he is, falling in love, and falling in love with a landscape that seems to dignify the love at the same time. So it's almost this beautiful, sad, melancholic, ecstatic hit parade of American sensibility. He gives accessibility in poetry a new name, comedy as well. It is, to my mind, an extraordinary pleasure to present Campbell McGrath to you. This reading is being broadcast simultaneously live. If you should find, and I wouldn't be surprised, you want to hear it again, it will be on this Sunday at KSFR 90.7 at 2 p.m. And you know, of course, 2 hours later, they air my program, Bookworm, at 4. This is a real cause for celebration. I give you Campbell McGrath.
Well, thank you, Michael, very much for that introduction. Thanks to everybody at the Lannan Foundation for bringing me here. Thanks to all of you for being here. I'm going to attempt to kind of live up to some of Michael's descriptions of me. And I think to do that, I'm going to start on the road and start out here in the West, in the Southwest in particular. I live in Miami, Florida, and I grew up in the Northeast and then in Chicago. But I've always loved coming out here for the sheer beauty of it. I want to start with two, then, little prose poems that are landscape pieces. The first of those, and that also talk about the region in a way, this is called Sunset, Route 90, Brewster County, Texas. Now the light is brass and pewter, alloyed metals solid as amber, allied with water, umber, and charnel, lucent as mercury, fugitive silver, chalk rose and coal blue, true, full of the skulls and skeletons of moonlight, ash light and furnace light, West Texas whiskey light, bevel light, cusp light, lightfall of arches and architectonics, earthlight and anchor light, sermon light, gospel light, light that clasps hands with the few and the many, mesa light, saltbush and longhorn light, barbed wire and freight train light, light of the suffering, light of the dusk fallen, wheel light and solace light, graveyard at the crossroads light, floodlight, harbor light, light of the windmills and light of the hills, light that starts the dove from the thistle, light that leads the horses to water, light of the boon and bounty of the Pecos, light of the Christ of Alpine, light of the Savior of Marathon, Jesus of cottonwood, Jesus of oil, Jesus of jackrabbits, Jesus of quail, Jesus of creosote, Jesus of slate, Jesus of solitude, Jesus of grace. On that same, thank you. You can, if you feel so called upon, applaud at the end, but you don't need to demonstrate that much. Thank you so much. I think it was the same road trip, driving like a 1972 white Impala convertible across the country to deliver to a friend in Los Angeles, that on this trip, not Ed or Charlie, but Elizabeth, my wife, was with me. And after West Texas, we wound our way through New Mexico, eventually through Santa Fe. And this is another little prose poem, a kind of travel piece called Mountain Air, New Mexico. Stopped for lunch after crossing the Malpais, that awful wasteland, desolate, sun-stricken, palpably grievous. Eyeless window sockets in the town of Clonch, the ruined pueblo at Gran Cavira. At the next table, folks were talking about the unusual cold of the previous winter. So much snow, a bear had come down from the mountains and roamed around town for days seeking shelter. You remember that bear? Oh, yeah. It was living over by Dale's place. Lunch arrived. Egg salad, pickles, iced tea. The door of the diner swung open, and a man in spurs and chaps and Stetson hat strode in, knocked the dust from his breeches, sidled up to the old wooden bar, and ordered a glass of milk. It came full and frothy. The cowboy drank it, wiped his lips on his sleeve, paid, and left. At the next table, they were still going at it. Whatever happened to that bear? Dale shot it. He shot it? Killed it? Yep. Is that legal, killing a bear? I don't know, but he sure did shoot it. I read that poem yesterday at a high school in Santa Fe talking to some students, and then I was informed by one of the teachers there that Clonch is, in fact, a beautiful place and by no means should be characterized by my description. That had I stopped in the post office in Clonch, I would have found it to be also a kind of local lending library, and I would have been transformed in my vision of Clonch. So I bear no animus. I want to switch now to another voice. We're also kind of touring through my books chronologically, basically. And I guess address the snake oil salesman voice Michael has so eloquently put it. I lived for many years in Chicago and wrote a poem once called the Bob Hope Poem, which is a 70-page kind of discussion of Bob Hope. Yes, in part of Bob Hope. But it's also about American culture, about American history, about the city of Chicago. It's a poem in which a narrator sits in his apartment in Chicago on a snowy day, looking out at the world, feeling a need to account for what he sees, a need that kind of constantly escalates, that as you explain one thing, you find yourself caught up in larger and larger skeins of meaning and attempts to understand it all, which in turn was catalyzed by the fact that my wife was pregnant with our first child at the time, and the need suddenly to account for the world went from something very abstract to something very literal for me. So I'm going to read a selection from that very long poem, about 4.5 pages. And this is from part 3 of the poem, which is known as Commodity Fetishism in the White City, referring to the World's Fair of 1894 or whatever it was. And there are a number of quotations scattered through this book. It's a kind of book that appropriates sources and texts. And so I'll kind of announce where it's from if I read one. So this is that narrator in that apartment in Chicago looking out at the world. Looking west from the kitchen, the weather is transformed. Storm light unrolls like a magic carpet, softens the lowering clouds. The snow, less ominous, windless, dropping straight down on the alley, garages and rooftops geometrically outlined, smokestacks, water towers, cottonwoods and maples, uniform back porches hammered from 2x4s and unfinished lumber. The backyard, a pillowed expanse extruding elbows and rockers of the overturned aluminum patio chairs. A charnel yard emerging from monsoon mud, or a battlefield reclaimed by creeping sand dunes. 13 days without sun, terminal overcast stalled above the city like a shield to protect us from what we most desire. Iron gray, relentless Chicago. My father tells me there is a depressive syndrome called seasonal affective disorder, SAD, which means the midwinter blues, which means we are, like flowers, heliotropic, subject to solstice, attuned to equinox and perihelion, which means we're even weirder than we think we are. Cushion of snow on the window ledge, whistling tea kettle, steam like the ghost of hot chocolate past. Feels like a day off from school. Licensed to curl up in blankets and watch The Price is Right until Mom comes home. Hey, I think I'll enjoy this tasty repast in front of the tube. Let's see now, leftover Chinese or liverwurst and Swiss? Look, that dog food's packed with real beef gravy. Will the celebrity spokesperson eat it? I'm still waiting for the advertising boys to break this taboo, leap this low hurdle, cross the Rubicon of bestiality and compel Robert Urich or Lauren Green or whichever down on his luck former primetime star to plunge a silver fork into those luscious nuggets and savor the rich, hearty flavor of all beef goodness just like Fido. After all, if I won't eat it, why should he? If it's good enough for my dog, it's good enough for me. Such a small, such a beautifully small, such an infinitesimally gorgeous abyss. Of course, meat was Chicago's first great industry, a virtual monopoly controlled by the South Side packing houses, Gustavus Swift and Philip Armour and the rest of their cutthroat cartel, their visionary manipulation of consumer psychology, the pickling vats and offal heaps laid bare by Upton Sinclair, vast fleets of refrigerator cars at the union stockyards manned by rock-bottom immigrant labor, the strong-shouldered muscle the city was built upon, the capital accumulation by which it was built, a real killing any way you slice it. If New York is an apple, Chicago is pure sausage. Chicago is liverwurst. Chicago is lumber, sow bellies, soybeans, freight trains. Chicago is the nexus where pigs and cows become puts and calls, where corn and copper become shorts and corners, where wheat transforms into paper promises premised on possible productivity, which is to say, the future, all by means of one simple equation, cattle drive, feedlot, slaughterhouse, board of trade, clear-cut, logjam, lumberyard, board of trade, amber waves, grist mill, wonder bread, board of trade. It's a form of modern alchemy, a public sacrament, an open secret. It's a quick trip on the L to the ornate observation balconies above the primal trading pits in the loop, where you can witness the literal transmogrification of the fruits of earthly labor into abstract quanta by gangs of men signifying with frantic gestures the private glyphs of their transnumerative calculus. A scene which never fails to remind me of apes learning sign language on the Discovery Channel. Their hierarchy and ritual deference, slow mastery of sign and indicator, the pathos of their struggle to articulate desire, give apple combi, play hide-and-seek combi, hug combi, please. Chicago has an apple for combi, if the price is right. Chicago is ready to talk turkey. Chicago is a great ape house gone bananas, a Hanseatic citadel in hog heaven, a mercantile carnation pinned to the lake's lapel, a magic hat from which the rabbit of capital is pulled, a portal into the realm of money itself. And as in all border towns, the locals grow rich off the unwary travelers they smilingly fleece and service. And here's a quote now from a book about early settlement in the Illinois prairie. In December 1836, an enterprising local miller bought up more than 1,000 hogs from Sugar Creek Farms and drove them down the road to American Bottom. 20 miles south of the creek, a sudden drastic drop in temperature caught him and his men, threatening them with killing cold. As they raced in panic for the shelter of a nearby cabin, their hogs began desperately to pile up on each other for warmth. Those on the inside smothered, those on the outside froze, creating a monumental pyramid of ham frozen on the hoof. The marketing experiment was a dead loss and the miller financially destroyed. So Chicago grew and grew fat off the fat of the heartland. So it is still more or less unchanged in its bluntly commercial convictions. Rich men wear fur coats in the streets because the weather is cold and they are rich. Factory workers drive Oldsmobiles because Oldsmobiles are better than Buicks and they don't make Packards anymore. Unemployed factory workers move out of the city because the only place hiring is Walmart, and it's cheaper out there in the hinterlands of Exurbia. Chicago is your basic meat and potatoes. Chicago is white bread. Chicago is a monumental pyramid of ham. This train of thought is spoiling my lunch. That's the problem with liverwurst. 20 minutes later, you're hungry again. Speaking of ham, Bob Hope has always been big in Chicago. 7 shows a day at the Stratford Theater, still glamorous in 1946. 7 shows. The man is nothing if not a fanatic, an indomitable trooper in the old joke factory, a faded rose of a star-spangled performaholic, although, like so much that we consider American, he's an imported model, not a true domestic. Son of a hard-drinking immigrant stonemason, Bob passed through Ellis Island early, en route from Bristol to his new home in Cleveland, where he evinced a precocious talent for comedy, a ready facility for cutting a rug, changed his name from the original Leslie and thus became Bob Hope, the Buckeye street pug, Bob Hope, the shill at the Alhambra pool hall, Bob Hope, the wisecracking street corner thug. Quit school at 16 to work in his uncle's butcher stall, hard-knuckled, hungry, lean and pale from the long days of oxblood and entrails, sour odor of meat beneath his fingernails during tap dance lessons at Sojak's Dance Academy on Lake Erie evenings, gray as a lunch pail, a 10th grade dropout with the gift of gab, an affinity for hard work, and a dream to escape blue-collar Ohio. A trinity familiar to every immigrant's son, the dream of new world wealth and glory, the American dream. And the rest, as they say, is history, which happens to be our story. Thank you. That was really fun because I haven't read from that poem in a very long time, and it was Michael that inspired me to do so with his, you know, Carney Barker credits to, of my... I moved from Chicago to South Florida, to Miami Beach, where I live, about 12 years ago, which is a very strange transformation, needless to say. And I want to turn to South Florida and read a few poems from my book, Florida Poems. This poem's called The Orange. Gone to swim after walking the boys to school. Overcast morning, midweek, off-season. Few souls to brave the warm, storm-tossed waves. Not wild, but rough for this tranquil coast. Swimming now, in rhythm, arm over arm. Let the ocean buoy the body and the legs work little. Wave overhead, crash and roll with it. Breathe, stretch and build, windmill, climb the foam, breathe, breathe. Traveling downwind, I make good time and spot the marker by which I know to halt and forge my way ashore. Who am I to question the current? Surely this is peace abiding. Walking back along the beach, I mark the signs of erosion, bide the usual flotsam of seagrass and fan coral, afloat from somebody's fishing boat, crusted with sponge and barnacles, and then I find the orange, single irradiant sphere on the sand, tide-washed, glistening as if newborn, golden orb, miraculous fruit, in all that sweep of horizon, the only point of color. Cross-legged on my towel, I let the juice course and mingle with the film of salt on my lips and the sand in my beard as I steadily peel and eat it. Considering the ancient lineage of this fruit, the long history of its dispersal around the globe on currents of animal and human migration, and in light of the importance of the citrus industry to the state of Florida, I will not claim it was the best and sweetest orange in the world, though it was, O great salt water of eternity, O strange and bountiful orchard. A tiny little poem called The Key Lime, in keeping with the tiny little size of the key lime. Curiously yellow hand grenade of flavor, Molotov cocktail for a revolution against the bland. That's it for that one. This is a love poem for my wife Elizabeth. It's called The Zebra Long Wing, and I'm sure you all know the zebra long wing is the state butterfly in Florida. And I don't know if New Mexico has a state butterfly. Interesting trivia question. I should have asked the high school kids that. And it relates an incident that kind of summarized for me the strange kind of magic of South Florida. In that one year after we'd moved there, second or third winter we were there, a colony of butterflies established themselves in our backyard in the roots of an orchid. And they lived there. They would wake up at dawn, or actually after, they would wake up after we had woken up and fly off for the day and then come back in the evening, fold up and just go to sleep. I mean, you could, you know, touch them and they were just sleeping there. I had no idea that, but you know, who knows what the secret life of butterflies. But in South Florida, this is kind of a commonplace. So it kind of came to typify that for me. It's called The Zebra Long Wing. Didn't really need that description since the poem tells you the same thing, but I enjoy telling the story. The Zebra Long Wing. 40 years I've waited, uncomprehending, for these winter nights when the butterflies fold themselves like paper cranes to sleep in the dangling roots of the orchids boxed and hung from the live oak tree. How many there are? 6, 8, 11. When I missed the spikes and blossoms by moonlight, they stir but do not wake, antennaed and dreaming of passion flower nectar. Never before have they gifted us in like manner. Never before have they stilled their flight in our garden. Wings have borne them away from the silk of the past, as surely as some merciful wind has delivered us to an anchorage of such abundant grace, Elizabeth. All my life I have searched, without knowing it, for this moment. I said earlier that Michael had inspired me to my most Carney Barker-esque. I'm going to stick to that. I was going to substitute the Bob Hope poem for this poem, but now I'm going to read both just to kind of, I know some people Atlanta and enjoy this poem. This poem's called Benediction for the Savior of Orlando. And I was really happy to learn, talking to the high school kids here yesterday, that Chuck E. Cheese is a figure of fear and admiration here in Santa Fe, just as he is across the rest of the country. And that, no stone has been left unturned by the Chuck E. Cheese empire, as it were. And this is a poem really about cell phones. No, it's about about America. In Orlando, which I think should be the capital of the state of Florida, perhaps the capital of the United States, if we think about it deeply enough. And this poem, I'll just say, ends with two voices speaking kind of interpolated, in which I'll kind of indicate with little hand gestures like this, and you'll know the poem's coming to end. And that's a voice speaking over the loudspeaker at Chuck E. Cheese and the voice of a person praying. So, Benediction for the Savior of Orlando. Signs and wonders. Jesus is Lord over greater Orlando, snake-tagged in cadmium on a vine-grown cyclone fence along I-4 southbound north of downtown is a credo that subverts the conventional wisdom that Walt Disney is the Messiah and his minions the christened stewards of this place, that the kingdom to come shall be Mickey's, that the bread of our communion will be proffered by ATM, and the wine quaffed without taint of sulfites or trademark infringement, all of which is certainly true, and yet too pat, too much like shooting mice in a barrel when there are nastier vermin to contest, and purgatories far worse than Disney's realm of immortal simulacra suckled at the breast of Lake Buena Vista. There is, for one, Orlando itself, Orlando rightly considered, Orlando qua Orlando. Nobody anywhere could honestly propose Orlando as a fit model for human habitation. City with the character of a turnpike restroom, city with the soul of a fast food establishment, sanitized and corporatized, homogenous and formulaic. Orlando is the holy land of the branded and franchised. Orlando is the Jerusalem of commodified delight. Orlando, Orlando, so many Orlandos, I commence to feel downright Shakespearean. But here is no Rosalind to dignify our tale, no touchstone to transform its tragedy to farce, because Orlando is the Florida I fear to conceive, Florida ordained like the antechamber to that afterworld where jackal-headed Anubis prepares his embalmer's instruments to pump our veins with tincture of liquid sunshine, until we are reduced to somnambulant acquiescence, a citizenry mummified within the cambric of material satiety, within the gated stucco walls of economic segregation and the hairy stucco arms of armed response security, a people determined to rev our outboards and troll for bass in the shadow of the form glass temples to corporate profit, while the fill ponds grow heavy with duckweed and algae and the golf courses burn with viridian fire through seasons of rain and seasons of drought, and the metropolis spreads ever outward the bland picnic blankets of its asphalt dominion, landscape drained of spontaneity and glee, bones boiled free of communal gristle. Is it any wonder the children of this America rise up with guns to wreak a senseless vengeance? The very children that might have saved us, the ones we had relied on to assemble in fellowship and attend to counsels of greater wisdom than those to which we have given credence. Perhaps the children were absent from school the day these lessons were offered, or perhaps the lessons had been censored from the curriculum, or there was no curriculum, or the schools had been demolished to make room for the future. A serial cataclysm of vinyl and asphalt, a republic of bananas and banana republics, where cars are the chosen and credit cards the elect, where Judge Judy balances the scales of justice, and the anthem of our freedom is sung by Chuck E. Cheese. Here I may testify with absolute conviction. Chuck E. Cheese is the monstrous embodiment of a nightmare, the bewhiskered Mephistopheles of ring toss, the diabolical vampire of our transcendent ideals. Every Chuck E. Cheese's erected across the mall lands of America is another nail in the coffin of human aspiration, and every hour spent in one takes 6 months off your life. No, it's not a theme restaurant or family amusement center, but a vision of infernal despair enjoined in plastic flames. The clownish horror of the place is unspeakable, yet I feel that I must speak of it. For I have been to the birthday party of Emily, turning 5. The birthday party of Max, turning 8 or 9, of Max again, of David and Doris, of Myrna and Roberto. I can bear witness to its odors of chocolate milk and floor cleanser, the Formica falsity of its processed cheese food pseudo-pizza, its banquet tables arrayed with pitchers of lurid orange soda, and the kids in the arcade room playing air hockey and whack-a-mole and teaching one another to cheat at skee-ball, to win a screel of coupons to redeem for tiny chintzy prizes, the worst sorts of craftily packaged trash, stringless army parachute guys, malformed monster finger puppets, Chinese yo-yos that self-destruct at the flip of a wrist. A rainbow-colored peep show designed to entice the youngest among us to invest their lives in a cycle of competitive consumption, and then the animatronic hoedown commences its banjo jangle. The hairy rodent orchestra cheering their cymbals on stage as the gray rat man emerges from his curtain redolent of mildew, the incubus, the secret sharer, Chuck E. Cheese himself, and the baby children scream in dismay, and the larger children gag with disinterest, and the parents pay no attention at all, while employees with the fear and candy-glazed eyeballs of medium security inmates stutter their prescripted remarks over a public address system in whose interstitial silences one may discern the voices of the lost upraised in prayer. We're having a great day at Chuck E. Cheese. Hear us, help us, grant us benison. Pick up your food at the counter, PJ. Comfort and guide us, lead us to salvation. Everyone loves family fun at Chuck E. Bestow the mercies of your blessing. Cheese for your safety, wear shoes at all times. Upon our souls, we beseech thee. Last call for pickup, PJ, last call. Lord of our fathers, almighty God. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, when I read that at universities, I always say, if by any chance the corporation of Chuck E. Cheese is a benefactor of the university, don't hold anyone else accountable, it's all me. I want to turn to my latest book, Pax Atomica. It's my sixth book of poems. It's not utterly dissimilar. It's about American culture. It uses rock and roll songs more consistently than other kind of cultural inquiry to kind of talk about America. And that comes from a kind of looking back into my own past, my own childhood in the 70s and 80s, and realizing that as I sought to go backwards in time, I was dating things, like an archaeologist using carbon dating, I was using the songs that I heard playing in my mind to know when something had occurred, and that kind of magical power of music to speak to us that way from the past. So I want to read a couple poems from this book, several of which are arranged with rock and roll songs. They're written in terza rima. And this one's called Adam and Eve. Sitting on the dock of the bay is everywhere that year, humming from the radio of the old blue Chevy at the brand new drive-through bank off Metzerat Road, where you'd get a purple lollipop from the lady if you were lucky. And then Otis Redding died in the plane wreck, or he already had, and that knowledge is bared to a child's scrutiny. And the keen of it enhances the soundtrack, grief and joy, each a movement, each a groove, each a tone to be born and abided, rueful and honey-struck as the untroubled melancholy of his voice. And then the assassination of Martin Luther King, first glimmer of the ways in which the melody's ampersand ensnares us, first inkling of the intertwined harmony of self and society, call and response, part and counterpart sung in the choral grandiloquence of the common polity, while the grave robbers torching oblivion comment more eloquently than any thin-tied anchor on TV. My father's commute to the city, dogged by the contagion of Georgia Avenue storefronts looted to cinders. And then my best friend's father sent off to Vietnam. We were still marginally military, Sunday dinner at the officers' club, and the inverse celebration when my Uncle Billy pulled a lucky draft number. He was my favorite babysitter, ball player, The one who took me to the drive-in to see the double feature that poured a mythological foundation for my adolescence. The good, the bad, and the ugly, followed by 1 million years B.C. Clint Eastwood and Raquel Welch as Adam and Eve. Ideal gender models. Everything we desired and desired to be. How could I have known the years it takes to unlearn certain lessons? Singing Sugar Sugar with the Archies in the back seat while the honeycomb of our innocence burned in the streets. Everything we would inherit, cast and scorified in the crucible of those years. How could I tell what was real from what was not? When Raquel pawed her caveman, I smiled. When Clint said draw, I shot. This is another one in that sequence. It's called Rock and Roll, taking its title from the Led Zeppelin song and commenting on the famous pastime of misunderstood rock and roll lyrics and the dangers of mistranslation in general. Rock and roll. Been a long time since I rock and rolled, Led Zeppelin says in its famous song called, quite rightly, Rock and Roll, as so many are, so far so good, but then what? Been a long time since I did the stroll, as Robert Plant would have it understood, or been a long time since the Dead Sea Scrolls. Both in their way are intelligible. Both possess sense-making apparatus and obey syntactical protocols. Both signify. Both are full of meaning. Both call to us across the void, hello. But their ways and means of meaning what they mean and saying what they say are as different as night from day. The first, a formulaic, stripped clean, boogie-woogie rant. The second, an implicit commentary on the historicity of the text, a not uncommon species of lit-crit-cant, coy reference to the complexity of deciphering what we hear and what we read in or out of context. Like the time in Verona, we could have seen Lou Reed in the Roman amphitheater that is one of the glories of Western civilization, but Elizabeth wouldn't go because she thought I meant Lou Rawls. This is a short poem again called Woe, which is W-O-E. I feel that's important to as opposed to like Woa, the cowboy motif that Santa Fe might inspire. Woe. Consider the human capacity for suffering, our insatiable appetite for woe. I do not say this lightly, but the sandwiches at Subway suck. Foaming lettuce, mayo like rancid bear grease, meat the color of a dead dog's tongue. Yet they are consumed by the millions and by the tens of millions. So much for the food. The rest I must pass over in silence. This poem is called Love, Copyright. Love with a little copyright symbol. I've got the copyright on love, honey baby. Registered patent number such and such. Don't dilly-dally with saxifrage and sassafras. Don't bother me with this and that. Don't mix the salt in my vanilla. You think a bird in the eye of the ocean of springtime knows love? Cinnamon, I'm drowning in it. Don't tell me it's cold because I'm burning with it. I've got the trademark. I've got the copyright. Cupcake, sweet molasses, sugar pie. This poem's called The Human Heart. We construct it from tin and ambergris and clay, ochre, graph paper, a funnel of ghosts, whirlpool and a downspout full of midsummer rain. It is, for all its freedom and obstinance, an artifact of human agency in its maverick intricacy. Its chaos reflected in earthly circumstance, its appetites mirrored by a hungry world like the lights of the casino in the coyote's eye. Old as the odor of almonds in the hills around Solano, filigreed and chanceled with flavor of blood oranges, fashioned from moonlight, yarn, nacre, cordite, shaped and assembled valve by valve, flange by flange, and finished with the carnal fire of interstellar dust. We build the human heart and lock it in its chest and hope that what we have made can save us. The final poem in this book and in that, the kind of rock and roll sequence that runs through it, it's called Everybody Knows John Lennon Is Dead. And I want to read that poem. It's a poem, it's set in the city of Seville in the south of Spain. And I read it for my sons, Sam and Jackson, who appear at the end of the poem. Seated on the avenue, eating almond ice cream beneath the orange trees, the Andalusian heat seems at last to have lessened, or at least there is a breeze to squall the dusty citrus leaves along the cobbled alleyways as a melange of ambient music emerges from the barrio, Eurodisco, Hendrix and the Beatles, flamenco guitar. A kid on a Vespa hops the curb to deliver a Serrano ham to the bar across the street, joint of a pig wrapped in muslin carried cross town on his shoulder. Nice to know they still resist our microbial foibles, our fetish with sterility, though there are clearly some exotic new strains of growth in Sevilla's petri dish. You can tell how much has changed by the Germans begowned in halter tops and spandex shorts, milling in fiendish prolixity around a cathedral that resembles a reticulated spider escaped from some dank cage of the Iberian Dark Age. As if every least rain droplet of the future were not equally and altogether new, alike as minted coins or the waters of the fountain before El Giralda, toward which even now the carriage horses stare in mute desire. Strange the way one's life comes to seem a historical diorama, looking back as from rocky peaks across golden valleys where regiments of moonlit sunflowers lay siege to the Alhambra. Sometimes, in the childhood of a now past century, my family would forego dinner to banquet on banana splits at the old Gifford's ice cream parlor out the parkway with the ornate water fountain and marble tabletops, cloth napkins and fluted silver spoons and formal glassware as here, though this, however reminiscent, is not American ice cream. You can tell by the intensity of flavor, the almondness of the almond, as you can tell from the woven rubber chairs that this is not my long-gone suburbia or any American anywhere, though it could perhaps be Rome 30 years ago when the street vendors hawked necklaces of hammered iron nails wired to leather thongs and those clickety-clackety plastic bolas in the floodlights along the Tiber, a city of bridges and diesel fumes and casual decay like this one, though you can tell it isn't Rome by the scent of rotten citrus in the air and the muzzled shadows of Moorish arches and the wine is wrong. And though it is always childhood for somebody, somewhere, it certainly isn't mine. You can tell because the boys are drawing aliens on the placemats with sugar crystal hair, still moving forward, not yet dreaming in reverse, trafficking in a brotherhood that promises never to end. And when Strawberry Fields fades down to street noise, Jackson asks, "Which Beatle sings that one, Dad?" And Sam says, "John Lennon." And Jackson says, "Idiot, everybody knows John Lennon is dead." Thank you. As I say, I really enjoyed the kind of chronological overview this has allowed me to come out here and do this reading and prepare for it and thinking about it. And so I wanted to end with three new poems that will be in some future volume. I'm not even sure when. They might not even be in the same volume. And this first poem is called Ode to Bureaucrats. And it's inspired by Pablo Neruda's odes to everyday elemental odes. And I work at a state university in Miami, Florida International University, and that's like working within, you know, the two kind of most Byzantine possible bureaucracies, a state government bureaucracy and an academic bureaucracy. So I remember when I started working there 12 years ago, I got to my office, which I had an office, which was nice, and there was my stapler and my tape, but I didn't have any scissors. And I just felt that I needed them. I don't even remember what I needed scissors for. And I said, "Oh, I need scissors." And so I went to the secretary. He said, "We can order those." I said, "That's great. Let's order up the scissors." And the scissors came eventually, and I'd really never seen anything like them. They were just really bad scissors in a way that was really kind of remarkable. And I said, I've got to write about these bad scissors. But I never did. And then I started writing this ode to bureaucrats based on all other principles altogether. And halfway through I said, it's the scissors. The scissors need to be in this poem. And that's what happens, so. It's called Ode to Bureaucrats and has a little epigram from Pablo Neruda's Ode to Things that says, I cherish tongs and scissors. Practitioners of oblivion, signatories of arcane regret, without whose seal we may not enter into paradise appropriately entailed. Fated duty, the onus of their diligence, the layers of it, sanctified and sacrificial, room of pallid eyeballs immured in fluorescent cubicles, municipal camouflage of coffee rings and uniform collars, vestibules of onion skin, reams and sheets and terminals, inkless stick pens chained to gouged linoleum as if to strike blood from a twig, their codes and initials and number two bubbles, verification and secondary verification, their official contrition, their sorrow, for there is nothing to be done. The renewal date has passed. The balance is insufficient. The identification numbers do not match. The procedure is not covered. The check is in the mail. The scissors you ordered have arrived in your office, and they are blunt and monstrous as the bill of a stork gone mad in mating season. Scissors an irascible child might have fashioned from humble elements as a plaything. Hinged flanges forged from metal too weak to whet or hone, bloodied by thumbs razored on ragged iron finger rings. Low-bid scissors procured by central purchasing. Scissors only the immortal chairman could love. Cheap scissors, bad scissors. These are your scissors, Mr. McGrath. Sign here, please, front and back in triplicate. This poem is called Luxury, a little poem. Luxury. Word skeins, ropes of language, flaxen cordage. What luxury to coil its supple circumference in spools, rolls, bobbins, reels. Weaving and looping, knotting, untangling, slipping a blade to its fibers. Instead of history, this entitlement, this private wonder, this poem. The final poem is a kind of, I think, brings us back full circle in that it's a small prose poem, a poem of place, and it's called Philadelphia. Late dinner at a dark cafe blocks from Rittenhouse Square. Iron pots of mussels and Belgian beer and a waiter eager to snag the check and clock out. Such are the summer pleasures of his work, winding down to a glass of red wine, catching the windowed reflection of a girl as she passes, counting the take upon the bar, thick roll of ones and fives, palming the odd ten smooth against zinc and polished walnut. The comforting dinginess of American money, color of August weeds in a yard of rusting appliances, hard cash, its halo of authority, the hand's delight in its fricatives and gutturals, its growl, its purr, gruff demotic against the jargon of paychecks on automatic deposit with social security deductions and prepaid dental, realism versus abstraction, a gallery of modest canvases, more landscapes than still lifes, steeples of the old city with masts and spars, a vista of water meadows with fishermen hauling nets in the distance, women collecting shellfish in wicker panniers. It yields enough to sustain us, after all, the ocean of the past. We've paid. The waiter pockets his final tip and throws down his apron and walks out into the warm night of dogs splashing in public fountains, and couples on benches beneath blossoming trees, and soon enough we follow, arm in arm across the cobblestones, looking for a yellow cab to carry us into the future. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
And when I got it, it came with someone else's notes in it that say in the margins things like, how true. And my favorite, quantity versus quality. Then came American Noise. I had to lend Campbell McGrath my copy of Spring Comes to Chicago, so I don't have it here to show you, but it was followed almost simultaneously by Road Atlas, a book of prose poems. Then came Florida Poems, which has an opening that's really astonishing. It's half Aristophanes, half Calvino, an attempt to build a city in the sky, an ideal city, and how quickly it's beset by the opposite of the ideal. It's a parable. It's a great and funny poem. And the most recent book is Pax Atomica. For those of you who are completists like me, he actually did a translation of Aristophanes, and the University of Pittsburgh Press, edited by David Slavitt, has done a series of new translations of Aristophanes by poets. I mean, all the translations in this book are by poets. Of course, Campbell McGrath is the funniest, but then again, some of the others aren't funny poets, and some of the others are more mysterious kinds of plays, but it brought on his interest in satire. There's also an issue of Plowshares magazine, so if you're curious about the kind of poetry and prose that Campbell McGrath likes, he edited that issue and chose everything in it. So let's have Campbell back on stage.
Here, I'm returning to you now, Michael.
That was the entire reason I did this.
Yeah. Now we have my extraneous copies here.
I wanted to start by talking about, we spoke this afternoon, and if you are one of those kinds of people who listen to Bookworm, and fortunately here in Santa Fe that happens a lot, you'll hear an entirely different conversation. And I'm making it my point to not talk about any of the things we talked about this afternoon so that you'll be surprised at our versatility. I wanted to talk about popular poetry, because it's something that really did die out. There was once a period, not just The Boy Stood on the Burning Deck and poems by Vachel Lindsay like The Bronco That Could Not Be Broken of Dancing, but poems by Carl Sandburg,
sure.
A whole tradition of poetry that people knew, and it went into a kind of desuetude. I don't think there are contemporary practitioners, and I don't think even Ron McEwen and that sort of thing fits this, because these were poems that people knew by heart. They were what people thought of were as American poetry. They're the reason why the poems on Hallmark cards sounded the way they did for a very long time, because that's what people thought poetry was. And then the whole thing went into a kind of decline because critics started denouncing it and we stopped having popular poetry. But I think that you like it and that you're partly an answer mm-hmm. to the popular poetry tradition.
Blame it all on modernism, I think, that, you know, things became, poetry is indeed a very marginal art form right now, and that's, you know, I often write as if I was writing to an audience of millions, as Whitman did, who are indeed never going to actually read the poems, but, you know, what can I do? It's the voice I feel makes sense somehow talking in my work, and I wish we had popular poetry. You know, I mean, I think that if you know, steelworkers in Detroit were reading Philip Levine poems in the morning on the way to work, it would be a better place. Their lives would be enriched and our culture would be enriched. I wish we had it back. You know, I thought that Robert Pinsky's favorite poem project was an attempt at restoring the notion of memorized poetry. That's saying, you know, what's happened to the notion that people have in their heads somewhere, words, lines, verse that really speaks to them, that's really vital in their lives in some way, and let's try to get it back. So will it come back? I don't know. You tell me, Michael, you know.
Well, I'm curious. You mentioned to me that you like Carl Sandburg.
Yeah.
And certainly this was a, He wrote a multi-volume Life of Lincoln.
Right.
This was not someone that you had to disrespect. It wasn't automatic. What happened? What's the story of this kind of thing?
I think that it's, poets like to blame the audience, and the audience likes to blame the poets. And I think there's truth to both. I think that, you know, poetry became in the 20th century difficult, obscure, and moved away from speaking to an audience, kind of consciously so. And therefore, the audience found itself alienated. And then the late 20th century, we had a kind of poetry being written that was written within the academy for academics and is kind of dry and airless and claustrophobic. And what sane reader would want to jump in that pool? So I think that it kind of worked both ways. The readership, what about novels? I feel like novels have declined in their sense of importance in the culture too. I mean, in an era in which, you know, let's say the 40s or the 50s, I mean, you know, what Hemingway or Norman Mailer or something like that was culturally, our novelists are not that anymore. I think that's what our filmmakers are now. So, I mean, in a sense, you know, kind of novels or prose supplanted a lot of poetry's place within the culture. And I think now that the culture has moved on to other media, especially the movies.
Because I think, you see, Campbell writes a kind of poem that is called an apostrophe. You know, you make an apostrophe to Chicago, hog butcher of the world, you know, famous Sandberg poem. And he has an apostrophe to a can of Schlitz among his, is it Schlitz?
Yeah, no, Schaefer.
Schaefer, I'm sorry. Yeah, the one beer to have when you're having more than one.
That's right, yes. A very politically incorrect kind of slogan, which, you know, perhaps points to its passing in the American marketplace.
But the glories of things that are in your own life, or the city that you yourself live in, or the place that you pass by hardly noticing, or even Chuck E. Cheese, the place that you hate. The poem that talks to the reader about a life lived,
yeah,
and about the economics of that life, seems to be very much a part of your project.
That is a big part of my project. That has been my project to date, I think, I mean, in poetry. And I have to plead, kind of insanity in a sense, in that it's a project that is addressing people. It's very complicated to talk about popular culture and poetry because those who share the Chuck E. Cheese experience at the nightmarish level that I have known it say, boy, that poem's great. You exactly got what I'm talking about. But then, of course, there are the multitudes that are like, well, what is Chuck E. Cheese? I've never been there. You know, if you're not of, you can kind of age date if you have children or grandchildren or yourself young enough to have gone there as a kid, you've been there. But if not, what does it mean to you? So talking to the culture and about the culture is really a powerful tool of connectivity to exactly those people who share your information. But anybody else, it's alienating in that you'd say, but I don't know that song. I don't know that place. So I think that's kind of why I try to write these books in which, well, maybe if you don't know Chuck E. Cheese or Led Zeppelin, you at least know what I'm talking about when I say I'm driving down an American road and here's what it's like, or what I'm thinking about American culture. So, you know, it's kind of casting a large net in the hopes of finding that connection.
Still, I think there's a huge difference between not having been to Chuck E. Cheese and not recognizing that line from Der Meistersinger, you know, that this is not T.S. Eliot, Phil. We're talking about a kind of poetry that's very interested in giving you, by context, exactly where you are. So I don't for a moment think, whether I've been in Chuck E. Cheese or not, that you're making it up, or that I have to read another book to find out what Chuck E. Cheese was in 1950. And in fact, these appropriations that go on are there to indicate to readers the external reality of what you're talking about.
I often write poetry in a kind of documentary vein to document the world that I've known, you know, like the world as I perceived it. And why not become a documentary filmmaker or a novelist or something? I often, you know, people might say. It just happens that, you know, I mean, I really, what I do is write poetry. It's what I love doing. It's what I can do. And my desire was to bear witness, to testify to the world that I saw. I mean, you know, a world about which I I feel a lot of ambivalence, I mean, a kind of passionate love for and then passionate antipathy towards different aspects of it. So, you know, I really do disagree that with the Eliotic notion of, you know, making poetry that's so obscure, you exclude everybody from it. That's just not my vision. But, you know, but that's not to say it shouldn't be someone else's vision.
Now, it seems to me that, you see, people call it travel, but I think it's vagabondage that is the essence, that at a certain point you leave home, presumably to someone's despair, to travel endlessly, what Pynchon calls yo-yoing in V, back and forth and back and forth between the coasts. How long did that last, and what was that like?
You can pin that on, you know, on Jack Kerouac in a sense. I, you know, just said, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to go get out there and drive across the country. And I think starting when I was about 19, that's what me and a bunch of my friends started to do. We used to be able to get drive-away cars where you didn't have to, you know, you were delivering a car for somebody from, say, Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles or from Chicago. It tended to be Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Los Angeles were our focal points to where our friends had relocated to go to college or whatever. And it cost you nothing but some gasoline. And even that sometimes they give you gasoline money if they really needed the car delivered. And it was a free way to get across the country and to see the country. And, you know, for a period of a decade, well, maybe less than a decade, 7 or 8 years, I really drove around the country kind of all the time. And then, you know, did it with my wife to be, and did it in different contexts. And it's not something I do with my kids. You know, we live in Miami, but every summer we drive from Miami up the East Coast to New Jersey, where we go to the Jersey Shore with my wife's extended family. And it's a totally different but equally fun and kind of amazing experience, you know, driving the American roads with kids. It's more of a Chuck E. Cheese experience, but it's, you know, this and a kind of jumping in the swimming pool at the Holiday Inn Express experience. But it's great. I mean, I've loved it, and I've loved exposing the kids to that same sense of, you know, looking out the car window at the beauty and the, you know, craziness and the ignorance and the wonderfulness of the world and of the culture.
Because one of the things that I think happened is that I think that popular American form, which I dearly love because it's funny and crazy, and I'm always telling people, you want to be condescending to Carl Sandburg, pick up the rutabaga stories. These are made up American folk tales and things like The Wedding of the Painted Doll. They're beautiful, beautiful things. The illustrations are great too. But I think Kerouac is the tradition of popular American poetry, and that accidentally this furor arose that had Truman Capote saying that's not writing, that's typing, and professors at Columbia University saying that's not literature.
Right.
But it was. It was popular literature.
Sure.
And they were so busy dealing with the aftermath of World War I and its poetry, the alienated soul poetry, that they didn't see anymore that there could be a poetry of wonder, which seems to me to be exemplified by Kerouac, by, strangely, Henry Miller, that our capacity for wonder is swollen by, in fact, our wondering at how horrible things have become, but that's still wonder.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, both Ginsberg and Kerouac are writers that influenced me a lot at the time, and it's... It strikes me as a relatively unimportant distinction that Kerouac's a prose writer and Ginsberg is a poet. I you know, if you read their work out loud, they're lyrical, they're rhythmic, they're cadenced. They both go back to Whitman kind of as a source. And Whitman, you know, Whitman was cataloging the world he saw. He was mostly celebratory, but he wasn't entirely celebratory. He was willing to, I mean, you know, the Civil War was the dominant event of his life. I mean, and the whole tone of his, you know, engagement with America turns from joy to elegiac, to tempered joy, to a kind of sadness. So, you know, the historical exigencies of the moment are you know, not going to cause me to despair of my project of both praising and, you know, kind of critiquing the culture. Because it goes on. Who knows where it's going?
Now, there you are, nevertheless, in a, you know, taking writing classes.
Yeah.
And writing a certain kind of poem that doesn't get written in writing classes anymore. I'm wondering, and I haven't seen anyone ask you about this, but did they try and take you away from your project? Did they say, no, no, this is 50s stuff. Right. Kiddo, no one writes like this.
Well, you know, some of each. I mean, teacher, you know, I'm a teacher of creative writing now, so, you know, you learn from teachers in two ways. You learn from certain teachers you emulate, and certain teachers you say, I know what they're telling me to do is what I don't want to do. I'm going to go the other direction. So I had some of both. I was talking with high school students about, you know, I had come out of college and of writing a kind of very intellectual, pound-like kind of poem. Went to the University of Chicago. It was deeply kind of intellectualized vision of poetry that I could write, and I guess I enjoyed writing, but it didn't really satisfy me. It didn't feel that authentic to my kind of heart or soul. And weirdly, in graduate school at Columbia, the beacon of the 7-Eleven showed up in my head as the kind of icon to guide me towards the poetic future. I mean, you know, part of that was maybe a little desire to be, you know, a little bit ironic, but part of it was to say, well, what is it then? You know, what, you know, if I'm being told in class to write about a great painting of the Florentine Renaissance, but I don't really want to because I don't have anything to say that 500 years worth of commentators haven't said, and it's not really that deeply attached to myself. What is it? And the 7-Eleven is what it is, for goodness sakes. You know, that's where I went. That's what I did with my life as a kid. And it seemed like a poem I needed to write. And it also seemed like a poem that hadn't been written, which was intimidating in that there's no model in a way, but also seemed therefore like a good reason to write it. You know, why isn't the 7-Eleven part of a poetic discourse somewhere? You know, I mean, it seems, and it seems, you know, as I've gone on trailing the track of the elusive poetic 7-Eleven kind of forever now, you know, it seems that as American culture becomes global culture, there's even more of a need, I think, for Americans to account for that culture. Mm-hmm. Not just, you know, in kind of governmental briefs, but within the culture, in art. And so I've taken that, and then there's another part of the kind of the imperial, that's the imperial half of the task as I see it, versus the personal documentary half of the task.
Now, I had the pleasure, really, of attending a reading by a wonderful young poet, Joe Wenderoth, who, much as you write about 7-Elevens or about Chuck E. Cheese, has written a whole book called Letters to Wendy's. Every time he goes, and he goes every day, he writes a letter to Wendy's, which is the size of a napkin. And I was listening to him, and he said, you know, I can't get over it. For me, I love poetry so much, and I love rock and roll so much. I don't understand what I need to do to make a poet into a rock star. And I think that, to some extent, those millions of people that you said that you're writing to, it's a rock audience that these poets poems address in a certain way.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, that what a lot of young poets aspire to be is, there's two models. One is a rock star, and the other is a stand-up comic. You know, both of which are roles that the poet used to fulfill societally, culturally, right? I mean, Aristophanes was the stand-up comic. You read Aristophanes' plays, and they are like, you know, Johnny Carson monologues, like Jay Leno monologues. They're drawn out of today's headlines. They're making it into comedy. They're making sense of it. They're pulling people out of the culture and mocking them. And that used to be what was the poet's role socially. And then there's the rock star role, the kind of, you know, doomed Orphic hero figure. That used to be the poet's role too. And they've both been stolen from poetry, as everything has been stolen from poetry. You know, this is just, you know, where's the popular poem gone? I feel like, you know, the pastures of poetry, you know, the herd of poetry has been steadily poached upon by the comics, the filmmakers, the novelists, everybody else. And, you know, I kind of often feel like kind of, you know, organizing the poets into like a counter raid.
You just gave me a very weird idea. It occurred to me that if Aristophanes was the stand-up comic of his culture, Euripides was the guy who plays heavy metal and bites the heads off chickens.
That might indeed be true. You know, but which is why, as I said, if they'd asked me to translate Euripides, I would have said, I don't think that's not suited for me. I'm going to go stick with the comic mode on that one. But, you know, I think poetry, I mean, this notion, what happened to the popular poem, popular poet? Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's Bob Dylan, maybe, or it's some lyrical filmmaker, or it's comedians. This is where I think young people who have a notion to, like, use language powerfully, you could use language powerfully in rock and roll. You can use language powerfully in comedy. I don't think it's poetry exactly, but it's some sort of, you know, really heightened lyrical discourse. I would love to recoup. It's interesting to hear Joe Wendroth would say that, you know, recoup that terrain for poetry. I think if you recoup that terrain, of course, you do also recoup that audience.
Yeah, well, it seems to me in a way mysterious, because all that would have to happen is for someone to go to a poetry reading where the poet is in the throes of being a poet reading poetry. Do you know what I mean? That insanity on the one hand and that extraordinary ecstasy and high spirit on the other. I have friends who, when I invite them to come to poetry readings, look at me as if I'm, you know, trying to trick them into, you know, an evening at speaking about God in a jail. And you know, I don't know what it would require to bring back the public forum. I mean, after all, Emerson was a hugely popular public speaker. Right. I mean, people loved to hear this stuff, and they'd leave feeling high. That was their word for it, elevated, you know? But that's what it was. It was ecstasy.
Well, yeah, I mean, readings, you know, there's a friend of mine, an English poet who actually published that book in England, Rupert Lloyd-Dell, said that someone asked him in an interview, what do you look for in a poetry reading? And he said two things, the bar and the exit. which sadly typifies the response of many, and it's maybe not an inappropriate response quite often. So what would it take to recoup that audience and to, you know, bring those kind of more Vatic roles back to the poet? I don't know. I mean, you know, I guess that what it comes down to for me is that I kind of learned to ignore the parts of the process I can't physically control. The history, the culture, the society that you're part of is kind of beyond your capacity in some sense to change. And so, I may be writing poems for an audience in some instances that isn't there, but it doesn't stop me from writing them. So, in other words, you know, well, I wish I knew the answers, I wish I could even, you know, start the process of recouping this terrain. Instead, I'm just going to write the poems and attend to that business that I can control, which is just creating the work.
Now, I wanted to talk a bit about the creation of the work. You mentioned that one of the poems you read was written in a sort of terza rima, and I noticed that was, by the way, that's a three-line stanza with a rhyme scheme that goes A-B-A, B-C-B, etc.
Right.
It's most famous, Dante used it. And I was surprised to see it turn up because it's Dante's using it because it represents the Trinity for him, mm-hmm. and it also represents the three-part nature of his work, which is hell and limbo and heaven. But I wondered, because it's there in your work, yeah, virtually from the beginning,
yeah,
and you slide in and out of it within a single poem.
Yeah, like in the section of the Bob Hope poem that I read, the final piece where it gets more kind of elegiac, more lyrical, falls into that terza rima. I mean, it's not a metrical terza rima, it rhymes kind of casually. Why? It's just that, you know, the mystery of form. I mean, I've always wanted to both, you know, speak to an audience that is at a complicated level and a very popular level, but I like the expansive prosy aspect of poetry. But I'm hugely drawn to more formal aspects of poetry, not purely formal, not metrical aspects, but I love writing. I love writing in rhyme. I love writing formally in ways. Form can be a straitjacket, or form can be really liberating. And for me, I find that terza rima very helpful. It really helped me in formulating the poems in Pax Atomica, because I'd had a lot of that material that I wanted to talk about. Like, I wanted to talk about the time we didn't go see the concert in Verona because Elizabeth thought Lou Reed was Lou Rawls. And I never could get it to work. And somehow the terza rima, the rhyme, gave me an organization to those poems and really made them work on the page.
I'm going to try a trick. I'm going to ask you to read that Zena poem, but without telling people the secret of how it's constructed, and give another example of form in poetry. I've got the page.
You got the page, okay.
Yeah. This is in the new book.
This is in the new book, and it's a culture and form. It's called Zena, Warrior Princess. Absolutely everyone is wild about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and hey, why not? Cute as a little blonde button, no doubt. It's just that I'm more easily excited by chicks in bondage straps and chainmail jerkins. Forgive me, it happens that I dig Xena's thing. I go ballistic when she and Hercules hook up. Oh man, it's incredible what that's like. Pure gravy, 100% natural juice. I'm cranked just thinking about Xena killing all the extras in a flourish after the third commercial. Listen, it's not as totally screwed up as it sounds. My ancient TV gets like 60-something channels. No way is that full spectrum. I mean, it's opening another can of nuts altogether, but how can I be positive there's not some even more red-blooded queen of ambidextrous rubber swordplay out there? Some righteous cable access babe in skin-tight skins or tights or Neanderthal whatnot or silver Teflon space bikini or that black elastic rattlesnake suit Uma wore in The Avengers. Uma, the Uber vixen. But what a movie. Woof. Some are born to run and some are born to rerun, Xena. So let's ride into that sunset together, babe. You with a posse of buffed up gal pals, me at my zenith of carnage and woo.
Just so you'll know, the first lines of the first letter, in fact, this is an alphabet poem. The lines begin, absolutely, Buffy, cute, doubt, easily, forgive, go, hook, it's, juice, killing, listen, my, no, opening, positive, queen, righteous, skins, Teflon, Uma, vixen, woof, Xena, you, zenith. This is a long-standing tradition, the Abecedarian poem. As I was reading, I didn't notice at first. The poem was so entertaining, and that word woof there so perfect that you don't stop to think what brought it into the poem. Tell me about those.
It's a totally fun form to write that way, and as I've said before, you really are. The X is by far the hardest word to use in English. So by using Xena, you've really solved your main problem in writing an alphabet poem. It's a really handy kind of trick to remember. And it's a form that I actually turn to when I'm a little bit stuck writing something. I just say, well, try to write something alphabetical. And it just forces me to maybe let go of kind of thinking and trying to control the process. And instead, I just go back to words. You know, I just say, well, what's there for letter D and letter E? And if some really fun word pops in my mind, I need to, I'll just try to construct the poem to get around those words. And yeah, in this book, there's four or five or six Abecedarian or alphabetical poems.
Well, including one that in alternate lines, it goes from A to Z and Z to A. And the poem seems to be about a war of cultures that eventuates in language, in alphabets. So eventually the formal thing becomes part of the subject of the poem.
In that poem, it does.
Yeah.
I mean, in my alphabet poems, sometimes they really help me get into another voice. You know, like that Xena guy, it's not precisely me. I actually written poems in absolute other voices. I wrote a poem as Elizabeth Bishop or whatever. And that alphabet form enables me somehow to get out of my own voice, which I'm often tired of as a writer. Like, enough about me, so let's get this guy going about Xena. That's the hope that of what form will bring to your work is discovery and something new, and as opposed to limiting you. You tell your students your graduate students to write a formal poem, and they all are up in arms. It's like a, you know, huge infringement on their freedom, which, you know, which is why it's fun to be the professor now. And but nonetheless, it's they, you know, they usually come around to say, you know, it was good to write it. I learned something. Even if I don't love the poem I wrote, the form helped me discover new things.
Well, I also wanted to talk to you about doing voices. I'll tell you a story. I was once sitting, not quite up here, but on another stage for the Lannan Foundation, talking to John Ashbery, mm-hmm. who basically refused to answer anything at all. He has a space between his front teeth, and by the time the evening was over, I was just sitting there mesmerized by the space within his, between his teeth while he didn't answer my questions, and looked at me in a dazed and peculiar manner. But at the dinner afterwards, when, you know, I wasn't so scared, and, you know, I admire him, so I was terribly scared, we started talking about the Fire Sign Theater, mm-hmm. That group of comics who were big in the late 60s, and he said, yeah, that's what I love, doing voices, the voices of the radio, radio crackle, the sound. Did you ever hear The Great Gildersleeve, he said to me out of the blue, and I said, well, what's that? Oh, the magician. I think John Ashbery is talking to me at dinner about The Great Gildersleeve at Firesign Theater. Why didn't we do it on the stage? But it seems to me that the voices, making funny voices, is part of what a poet does, and coming in and out of characters, that even T.S. Eliot do the police in different voices.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it can be. It's not what Emily Dickinson did, I don't think. But, there's always an alternative model in poetry, which is one of the nice things about it. But it's a way of, you know, I mean, and Ashbery's voices are, you know, simultaneously, you know, absurdist and comic and then, you know, lyrical, elegiac. I mean, he is such a master of those different kinds of voices, which then his persona is so different from that it is, you know, consternating to, like, read with him, as I did once, too. But, you know, I for me, it's a way of getting at the culture again. It's a way of saying, well, I love testifying to my... I feel most comfortable talking about what I actually know. I feel it's imposing on the world to make things up. But someone else might know something different, and maybe I can be that person in a poem. So that's what the voice, accessing other voices, does for my work.
Well, it was a pleasure to be hearing your voice at last, having spent the last several weeks with a voice on the page. And I really enjoyed having the opportunity to meet you.
Thanks, Michael. It was great talking today several times. Thank you so much.
Campbell McGrath. Campbell will be signing books in the lobby just after this meeting. So.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.